morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, February 5th, 2019. Some South Sudanese religious leaders say forces from the government and opposition are blocking efforts to reconcile communities torn apart by conflict.
If we want to forgive one another, what about the rest who are also inside? This means the forgiveness has no meaning. That is why we say that it is good to release even those who are in prison. People will know that government is really serious. Not only the government, those who are also in the bush.
And the EU pledged more funding to South Sudan if the peace deal holds.
Since the peace agreement was signed, we've already managed to access more funding. I can't quite talk about yet, but that we are very confident about. And as you say, it really is very dependent on the peace.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some religious leaders in Yei River State say human rights abuses and violations of the ceasefire by both government and armed opposition forces is undermining efforts by the church to promote reconciliation among communities. Daniel Friday Martin reports for VOA from Yei.
Over the past few months, forces with former warring parties have arrested, detained, abducted, or brutally killed civilians in parts of Yei River State. South Sudanese who live in both government and rebel-controlled areas say, even though leaders of both sides signed the River Talas peace agreement in September, armed men still torture civilians and restrict them from moving freely. In an exclusive interview with South Sudan in Focus, Reverend Levi Maele, curate of the Episcopal Diocese of Yei, says the abuse of civilians by government and rebel forces hampers efforts to promote peace and reconcile communities.
If we want to forgive one another, what about the rest who are also inside? This means the forgiveness has no meaning. That is why we say that it is good to release even those who are in prison. People will know that government is really serious. Not only the government, those who are also in the bush. This is the time to release all those who are in captivity so that they will come out and people will be at peace in this country.
African Inland Church pastor Joseph Laila says while both government and armed opposition leaders are preaching peace in public, their forces on the ground are violating the terms of the agreement.
An incident that happened, known to all of us as citizens in Yei, that number of our fellow young men were arrested and jailed in the prison. It is so much terrifying that we'll question even the peace agreement. More especially those who want to return home from the exile, and they will see that they still things like that happens. For sure, it will be so terrifying. And I would want to say on behalf of the church that we are for peace. For sure, people have to forgive each other.
Ali Moga, Secretary General of the Islamic Council in Yei River State, says both Christian and Muslim leaders have agreed to speak with one voice to demand good governance and respect for human rights.
Our appeal and the hope is that all detainees on both sides, inside and outside, should be set free so that we realize the real peace, a reconciliation for the revitalized peace agreement to be a reality.
Most local government administrative centers and towns in Yei River State are under the control of government forces, while rural areas are predominantly under the control of SPLA-IO rebels led by Riek Machar or the National Salvation Front rebel forces led by General Thomas Cirilo. Cirilo refused to sign the September peace deal. SPLA-IO Deputy Military Spokesman Colonel Lampol Gabriel says his forces support peace and reconciliation efforts by religious leaders.
As the SPLA-IO, we don't have any problem with anybody, specifically even the religious leaders. We want them to seek peace, so they are free to move to our territory. A lot of activities are already taking place, but also we need a major one, is reconciliation. The SPLA-IO does not have people in jail at the moment, apart from personnel that belong to us. We only have our maybe stubborn soldiers. We signed the peace agreement. We are committed to everything as far as the peace agreement is concerned. And beyond that, because right now we are for peace.
Samuel Subamanas, spokesman for the National Salvation Front, denies his group is detaining any civilians and insists his group supports dialogue to end the conflict in South Sudan. The National Salvation Front values the role of the religious leaders in peace building. We prioritize dialogue to resolve the problem of conflict in South Sudan. We are ready to meet the church leaders and share ideas on how we can bring peace in South Sudan and particularly in Yei River State. However, we also need the people to know that the government in Juba is not ready for dialogue because they believe in military might. Suba claims NAS has no civilians under detention in the areas it controls. Yei River State Information Minister Zakaria Duku Enoka says the state government is committed to respecting all human rights and has released of all civilian detainees in government detention cells. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yei.
The European Union has pledged to increase its development assistance to South Sudan if the revitalized peace deal holds. The head of the EU delegation to South Sudan says EU will soon launch a €22 million project aimed at benefiting tens of thousands of children across South Sudan. Wake Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
In an exclusive interview with South Sudan in Focus, Ambassador Sunet Wells, head of the European Union delegation to South Sudan, said the EU is willing to increase its financial support for South Sudan because it wants to see peace restored in South Sudan. Wells says should the peace deal halt, the EU will invest in South Sudanese development projects such as education programs rather than humanitarian assistance to help the country's economy up and running.
We want to do more, and we have already, since the peace agreement was signed, we've already managed to access more funding. The education that I mentioned and others, which I can't quite talk about yet, but that we are very confident about. And as you say, it really is very dependent on the peace.
Next month, the European Union will launch a €22 million project dubbed Education in Emergencies. Wells says the project targets children in the former states of Northern Barrel Ghazal, Western Barrel Ghazal, Warap, and Eastern Equatorium so that 75,000 South Sudanese children receive a proper education. Noting the dire humanitarian situation in South Sudan, Wells is calling on other donors to throw their support behind development activities in the country.
It's really, really critical. There's very vulnerable citizens in this country who need protection, who need nutritional support, healthcare and so on because of the situation that they're in. But we very much hope over time that we can move away from such a large amount of expenditure on humanitarian programs and really try to put money into supporting the long-term development of this country.
Wells says it's not easy lobbying for funds inside the EU to support South Sudan.
The reason for that is that South Sudan is in a bit of an exceptional category because most of the EU's support to African countries is governed by something called the Cotonou Agreement, which South Sudan is not a part of.
The Cotonou Agreement is a partnership signed by 79 African, Caribbean and Pacific or ACP countries and the European Union nearly 19 years ago for a 20-year period extending from 2000 to 2020. The agreement was designed to establish a comprehensive partnership with three pillars: development cooperation, political cooperation, and economic and trade cooperation. Wells says in addition to providing humanitarian assistance, the EU funds development projects aimed at enhancing food security, improving feeder roads, education, agriculture, and healthcare programs. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The Coalition for the International Criminal Court this week called on the European Union to publicly announce their withdrawal from a joint summit with the League of Arab States unless an invitation to Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir is cancelled. The Sudanese president is wanted by the ICC for genocide, war crime, and crimes against humanity. William Pace, convener of the Coalition for The International Criminal Court tells Ricky Shryok why EU's attendance at the event is unacceptable.
Since 2009 and 10, there have been arrest warrants issued by the International Criminal Court judges for war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide. The European Union has been one of the strongest supporters of the Rome Statute, so we're basically asking them to enforce their own policies and laws of the EU, that they should not co-sponsor a conference where a person indicted for war crimes and crimes against humanity would be invited. That's the basic issue. And for 13 years, the victims of the crimes in Darfur have suffered and waited around for justice. The United Nations estimates that at least 300,000 people may have been killed in attacks and died of conflict-induced starvation and disease, and more than 2 million people were forced to flee to refugee or internally displaced people's camps. So,
and do you think, in addition to those crimes, obviously Sudan is right now in a state of crisis. According to Amnesty International, 37 people have been killed over the past 5 weeks after security forces fired into crowds. There's massive protests against President Bashir. Do you think that especially in this moment, it is important that the EU make a stance?
Well, on any moment, but yes, in this moment, there you do have the internal demonstrations by the civil society in Sudan who also want justice. And obviously, if the Sudanese courts had ever responded to the terrible crimes that were occurring in Darfur, there wouldn't have been a need for an international court to assist or for the UN Security Council to refer the matter.
Have you heard back?
Well, we would be very surprised if Omar Bashir attends the meeting.
Why is that?
Because there's so much at stake in terms of cooperation with the European Union and development.
Does it also complicate matters that it's a joint summit between the EU and the League of Arab States? What is the League of Arab States' relationship with the ICC in general?
Well, I don't think there is a formal relationship. I know that some of the members of the League have ratified the Rome Statute, but most have not ratified the Rome Statute. And while we've had leaders of the Arab League being supportive of the Rome Statute and the ICC, that it's still a very controversial treaty, precisely because it says no matter who you are, if you've committed these crimes and the court would have jurisdiction, you will be investigated and prosecuted. Africans will also note that recently two heads of states have been basically acquitted by the International Criminal Court. So the idea that the ICC is not providing independent and fair trials is false on the face of it.
That was William Percy, convener of the Coalition for the International Criminal Court. He was speaking to Ricky Shryok. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudan gets a boost in its preparation to fight Ebola outbreak from the neighboring country. Find out more when we come back after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is there anything you completed simply because you were told you couldn't?
Actually, in my life, all my plans, they are all going on well. There's nothing which has defeated me, and people can say, for you, you are just doing this one, you cannot manage. Actually, I've not gone through that experience.
Yeah, actually, there is. When I was in secondary school, people were telling me that I should not take science section. They say that I cannot make it. So I decided to take it, and I did it. I did science section, and it was very okay.
Yes, actually, when I started my primary school, some of my friends were telling me that I will never get number one. But because I see it was a challenge, but I try my level best. After all, I was number one.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we are talking about the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The UN Center for Emergency Response Funds is helping South Sudan boost its emergency preparedness against the threat of Ebola reaching its borders from the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in South Sudan says they have received $2 million set up emergency units and educate communities on hygiene practices in order to avert any possible outbreak. Dimo Silva Aurelio has the story for VOA from Juba.
The Ebola outbreak was announced in the DRC in August last year. Since then, it has claimed more than 400 lives. There have been 700 suspected cases reported as of January 29. The World Health Organization says given its close proximity to the DRC, South Sudan is at high risk of seeing cases of Ebola. Steve O'Malley, head of United Nations Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, says OCHA received the $2 million from the UN Central Emergency Response Funds, or CEF, a fund created by the UN General Assembly to speed up the process of getting money out in crisis situations.
The CERF decided to give $10 million to the countries neighboring the DRC. So South Sudan, Uganda, Rwanda, and Burundi each got about $2 million, a little more, a little less, to strengthen their preparedness, their critical preparedness efforts.
The money is used to help strengthen surveillance, build case management capacities, enhance laboratory services, and increase infection prevention and control in those countries. Fighting the spread of Ebola goes hand in hand with improving sanitation. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, received $500,000 to improve water and sanitation services in South Sudan, particularly in schools and other public places along the DRC-South Sudan border. Marine Mosnia is UNICEF's coordinator for Ebola preparedness and response in South Sudan.
With the new CERF program, we will focus on 50 health facilities, as I already mentioned. We will focus as well in 20 schools, because it's very important that the school have a proper, hand washing system at the entry. We will focus as well in marketplaces, because it's where, you know, we see a lot of population movement, and mainly in Greater Equatoria, where you have a lot of people from DRC or even Uganda coming to the marketplaces. And as well, all the prayer area, which is a church, mosque, where we will as well improve the WASH IPC in this location.
Mosnia says the program targets about 100,000 people in South Sudan and about 35,000 IDPs. Dr. Tesome Adebabaye, the head of the health department at the International Organization for Migration Office in South Sudan, says his organization received more than $400,000 from CEF for Ebola preparedness activities in the country. Adebabaye says IOM will use the money to set up 10 emergency centers and to improve its tracking of displaced people and other people on the move.
The funding has come, I think, at the right point in time. So we are getting funding from USAID and CERF for the overall Ebola response of IOM in South Sudan. So CERF funding is complementary to what is already USAID funding is doing. So it will go into all of the 18 point of entry screening sites.
IOM operates 8 screening sites at crossing points along the South Sudan DRC and South Sudan Uganda borders. But Adebabaye says it is a challenge for IOM to reach rural areas to provide similar services.
For example, IOM is reaching the very security complex areas in Greater Yei State, also with a very challenging infrastructure situation. But then IOM role, especially for the screening, is to identify a suspected case and to report to the second level of agencies to take the process from there.
South Sudan's Health Ministry, in partnership with the WHO, says it has also stepped up preparedness measures against the spread of the disease by strengthening surveillance systems. Last week, the health ministry began vaccinating dozens of health workers at border areas with the DRC after receiving more than 2,100 doses of the Ebola vaccine, the Zaire strain, from MEX, the vaccine developer. Ebola virus is a hemorrhagic disease that can cause death to humans and animals and can be transmitted through contact with body fluids of an infected person. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Still on health matters, some residents of Juba support the ban on skin bleaching products in South Sudan. One resident says she is proud of her skin color, adding that skin bleaching is a waste of money. Winnie Chirino has more for VOA from Juba.
24-year-old Jokodo Esther says she loves her skin color and cannot change it. She says her black skin color matches the hot environment in South Sudan. And Esther says bleaching can cause serious skin damage like cancer.
Personally, had a chat with one of my friends. She grew up from the Arab world and she has been bleaching. So I tried to talk to her and find out why she's bleaching. I think it's peer pressure. If you're among, just like, you know, being in Arab world and people are brown, most of them, they are brown. And, you know, when you're dark and you're around brown people, you are forced to go and change your color such that you can fit in a group.
30-year-old Ayakater says she too supports the government's ban on skin bleaching products. She says young school girls and even some men have started bleaching their skins in South Sudan. Speaking in Arabic, Ater says she believes skin bleaching is a bad choice.
You will be light-skinned, but it can also cause unhappiness to someone because it is expensive. When you don't have it, you will not be happy. Like if I smear bleaching cream today and a few days I don't have it, my skin color will not go back to the previous skin. It will be very bad. Those who use bleaching cream are like those under daily medication, like those suffering from skin diseases, because they every day have to take medicine.
28-year-old Kiden Lulu says some of the skin products produce a bad smell.
There was this one time I was in a taxi and the masalat stopped and a lady came in and my goodness, it was terrible. The smell in itself, I almost threw up because of that smell. And especially since it's ladies. Ladies, we are supposed to be people who smell wonderful. We're like flowers, you know, we're beautiful. And so if beauty is losing your aura to looking good, then I don't get it. You'd rather look black and beautiful and still smell awesome.
Dr. Fred Wani, a physician at Juba Medical Complex, says he has treated many patients who have bleached their skins. He says he is glad the government has banned the importation of skin bleaching products. Wani notes many people are not aware that skin products contain mercury and hydroquinone chemicals that damage the skin's texture and can even damage certain organs.
These creams do contain chemicals that damage many parts of the body. Most of the mercury do damage the kidneys mainly. And if only our people know that in South Sudan currently the management of kidney disease is very difficult because we just don't have the facilities. So if they can avoid damaging their kidneys, we'll have saved a lot of people.
Dr. Wani also says bleaching products make skin so thin that patients are more susceptible to injuries and bleeding. Last week, the Drug and Food Control Authority banned skin bleaching products in South Sudan because the products have been linked to cancer and can damage the kidney and liver. Other African countries, including South Africa, Kenya, Ghana, and Rwanda, have also banned the importation of skin bleaching products. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
While in Kenya, health officials say unsafe abortions are common in the East African nation, with nearly 500,000 in the recent year. Abortion is prohibited unless, in the opinion of a health professional, there is a need for emergency treatment or the life or health of the mother is in danger. Advocates for less restriction policies argue that unsafe abortion contribute to a high level of maternal deaths. Rahel Ombou reports from Nairobi.
Martha Hope, not her real name, was married with three children when she became pregnant again in 2010. The 33-year-old woman says her husband told her he was not ready to bring up another child in poverty. At 6 months, she visited a neighborhood clinic that was willing to provide an illegal abortion. The doctor mixed some concoctions for her to take. Martha says she started bleeding and that she sat in a bucket full of cold water. As she put it, "I was sweating and losing strength. The fetus came out, but now the problem was that the placenta did not. I passed out." Martha is now on medication for depression as a result of the trauma she experienced. A 2018 report indicated that nearly 500,000 unsafe abortions occurred in Kenya in 2012. Justin Kamau, a nurse at Provide International Hospital in Dandora, says back alley abortions are all too common.
We may get 3 to 4 cases in a month in our facility, but remember there are others who die at home, who may be maybe no one to bring them to the facility. Maybe they opted not to tell anybody.
For the last 30 years, the Marisops organization has provided a wide range of maternal health services, including family planning, safe abortion, and post-abortion care in Kenya. The organization says 7 women in Kenya die daily from unsafe abortions. Dana Tilson is the Maristops Kenya country director.
There are multiple causes for this, including restrictions in the law for safe abortion and including lack of information by women and girls about where to get safe services. And there's also, particularly for young people, limited access to contraception. And when you have a situation where contraception is limited, there's a stigma around younger people getting pregnant and having sex before marriage.
Last year, the Kenya Film Classification Board banned a Marisops media campaign that sought to raise awareness about unsafe abortions. According to the board, the campaign encouraged teenagers to obtain the procedure. Marisops was then temporarily banned from providing safe abortions in the country. Virginia Nehemiah of Crisis Pregnancy, a faith-based Christian organization in Kenya, says her group helps women make a different choice.
The issue of choice only considers two choices, carry or abort. There are other choices, but people don't always talk about them. There is adoption. How many families are out there are not getting babies and they want children?
Tilson says women terminate pregnancies for various reasons.
They have an unwanted or unintended pregnancy. They're often desperate and they don't know where to go. And no matter what, they're going to terminate that pregnancy. And so they'll do anything to do that. And so often they will go to a backstreet abortionist. And these quacks are very dangerous.
For decades, the U.S. government has been a big donor for family planning services in Africa. However, the global gag rule that President Donald Trump signed when he took office in 2017 bans the U.S. from giving any money in development aid to any overseas organization that promotes or provides abortions. This has affected operations of NGOs such as Maristops. When the gag order was signed, Maristops said it lost about $30 million for multiple countries where it had been receiving U.S. funding for family planning. The World Health Organization estimates 25 million unsafe abortions take place globally each year, with almost all in developing countries. Rai Lombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Kelele by Hard Life Avenue Stars. Been listening to Hard Life Avenue with the song Kelele. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could join us. If you're planning to be out of Juba, where you cannot find an FM radio station, you can still tune on to our show. Our frequency is 11850 kilohertz, 13865 kilohertz, and 15180 kilohertz. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.